From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process with today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On Story features discussions with screenwriters and filmmakers who use the language of film and television to tell a story. All of our content is recorded live at the Austin Film Festival, in year-round events, and in up-to-the-minute interviews. On this week's episode, we'll hear from the creators behind the upcoming comedy heist film, Ocean's 8. Screenwriters Olivia Milch and Gary Ross discuss spinning off a popular franchise and approaching the heist genre from a new perspective. And later, we'll hear from King of the Hill writer and Bob's Burgers showrunner, Jim Dotrieve, on writing for animation and how characters develop over a series' lifetime.
I never assumed that anything other than it was going to be a good show that would succeed.
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Ocean's 8 is an upcoming comedy heist film that remixes Steven Soderbergh's Ocean 11 trilogy. The film brings a unique perspective to the genre by featuring an all-star, all-female cast. The idea for the film was created by four-time Academy Award-nominated writer-director Gary Ross. Ross co-wrote the comedy classic Big, and went on to write and direct Pleasantville, Seabiscuit, The Hunger Games, and 2016's Free State of Jones. Ross co-wrote the Ocean's 8 screenplay with filmmaker Olivia Milch, who has made a name for herself by writing stories that authentically represent the female experience. Earlier this year, she released her directorial debut, Dude, on Netflix. I recently spoke with Ross and Milch over the phone to discuss their collaboration and how to find new stories to tell in an existing franchise. Trailer of Ocean's 8, courtesy of Warner Brothers Entertainment, Inc.
In 3.5 weeks, the Met will be hosting its annual ball. And we are going to rob it. Not the ball itself,
on the neck of Daphne Kluger.
Valued at over $100
million.
$150 million, actually.
Revenge. It's a twofer.
That's just what they do.
Do not run a job in a job.
One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over
you. Taylor Swift? Can't we just go to this? Do we have to steal stuff?
Yes.
I had come up with the idea for the project probably 6 or 8 months before Olivia and I started working on it. It was kind of an outgrowth of Hunger Games. I mean, one of the things that stuck with me on Hunger Games was how resonant that kind of a protagonist was to girls who rarely got to see someone like Jennifer in that kind of a role, in that kind of a movie. And so I think that lingered with me a bit. And then I was wondering about this sort of an ensemble, you know, in the heist genre in general and stuff like that, and realized this had never taken place with women before. When Olivia and I got together to work on this, I think that we both enjoyed kind of appropriating that real estate and turning it on its ear a little bit and enjoyed engaging in that. And, I hadn't really written with anyone since Big. And so that was really thrilling and an exciting thing to do.
We originally had met and been working on projects, thinking about 19th century U.S. history a lot, and we had sort of met through a mutual love of that and been having a lot of exciting intellectual exchanges about that. And then when Gary was talking about this idea that he had, it was so thrilling and wonderful to be able to continue that kind of collaboration. We already sort of knew how much we enjoyed working together. And then to sort of start down the road on this, which was so much fun and such a delight. And the heist genre in and of itself is so elastic there, and there's so much to be done within it. And the fact that we had never seen one with all women before was sort of shocking, and I think speaks to, you know, that Gary really tapped into something that we were ready for.
I mean, I think actually the fact that we are of different genders and different ages really helped inform this writing process, because we each brought a unique perspective to the other, and that conversation produced a third thing, which in the writing process I think was invaluable, whereas each of us could have gotten off into our own eddies.
Absolutely.
And that we had a lot of kind of probative, deep conversations about the themes in the movie, feminism in general, what these things mean. And it was, a lot of those conversations were really, really illuminating and an exciting part of the process.
Well, there's not a, just not a lot of material like that out there, you know, where women are in this position. I mean, you kind of have some characters like In a Fish Called Wanda or Grifters or Paper Moon, maybe even. But how did you all decide how you were going to develop these characters and sort of turn the other oceans on its ear, so to speak?
I mean, you know, part of it is a little bit of the Bechdel test, right? It's one thing to have those characters, but are there conversations between women that aren't about a man? How is this a fully autonomous experience not defined in relation or reflective of the male experience? How does this become completely autonomous? And that's something that we actually talked about. And my daughter said to us early on, she said, you know, don't work so hard to come up with an emotional motivation for this. Why can't we just feel stuff like the guys do? And it was a very interesting kind of lodestar for us.
Yeah. Again, I think that within the kind of the heist genre, it's about the intricacy of the plot and figuring it out and the nuance and the complexity and the planning. There's a lot of fun to be had in that. And so to think about each one of these women and their unique skill set and what they would bring and the alchemy of the group and how the team would come together to pull this off, that's exciting regardless of the gender of the characters, you know, and that's something I think audiences want to see, but it makes it even more innovative and exciting and eye-opening for audiences because they've never seen before a group of women do something like this. And I think the hope is, of course, that eventually that won't be such a surprise or that won't be something that's so new, and that will be much more commonplace. But it certainly was a pretty magical experience to get to look up on the set and then now look up on the screen and see this group of women pulling this off together.
I have to say, my daughter has made me promise to take her on opening night, and she's largely excited, not just by the cast, but the concept. So one thing I'm really curious about, you both written original scripts before there was cast involved, but this is a pretty intense cast to have here, a lot of personality. How did you go about developing and writing this, knowing that you already had some of these people attached?
The characters that are cast already, which at the beginning it was only Sandy, we write to that actor. We wrote hoping that Kate would do it, to the point that we called the character Kate until just before we shot, she gently told us that it might be a good idea to change the name.
Yeah.
And then other characters really undergo a rewrite, and we investigate them a little deeper and change the way we wrote them when we cast that character. So when Rihanna comes on board, this hacker turned into someone who was from the Caribbean, who had a certain Rasta antecedent, and we talked to Rihanna about that and developed that with her. Similarly, with Mindy's character, we discovered that there was a thriving Indian American community in Jackson Heights where we're going to shoot, and that community had a thriving jewelry industry. Mm-hmm. So there was a bit of tailoring that occurred for the individual characters as they came on board with more specificity, and we got to write to them.
You both have actually written comedies, though I would say people don't necessarily consider you all to be comedy writers, so to speak. So, I mean, how did you all work that together? Because clearly you both have a sense of humor with your writing.
Most of it, I mean, people are surprised at this, but most of it happens side by side in front of a computer screen. I know a lot of other teams, Elton John barely talks to Bernie Taupin, he just sends him lyrics, you know. That's not our situation. We literally sit side by side at a screen, and we pitch the scene verbally beforehand. And either I have the keyboard or Olivia has the keyboard, and one of us is watching and one of us is typing, and the other one will be pitching lines as we go. That's a good idea. We'll go up and like go on a different tangent. What do you think of this? I think this, not that. And there's a very kind of like a jazz flow to have the way the scene happens. And we rough it and we go, yeah, that's good. And then we'll like tinker with it and play with it. But it's not like one of us goes and does a rough draft and hands it to the other. It's really happening in real time after a pretty extensive conversation. And it's happening in front of both of us.
Yeah, and I think, again, speaking to the tenor of an ocean film, that kind of jazzy, breezy, that humor and that patter was really organic and came from a dialogue that we were having. We got to have a lot of fun playing around with it. And then when you add people like, you know, Sarah Paulson or Mindy Kaling, and there's so much wonderful collaboration and improv that's going on, and you get to respond to that as a writer and hear what they're doing and continue to evolve the script. And so, you know, we certainly make ourselves laugh at the keyboard, and the hope was that, you know, that translates. And
yeah, that's the thing about comedy, right? It's like, you never know if, like, the joke you wrote is going to be that funny. And it really is about what the actor finds comfortable and funny, because more than drama, they have to really be the vehicle for, they have to fully understand what the humor is in the moment in order to be able to land it. So a lot of the good humor in a comedy just comes out of that dynamic with the actor and finding it.
Well, so last big question is, what about this project? I mean, it sounds like right from the start, you're doing something different here. And what about the project was, you know, surprising to you, or an unexpected revelation that came out of the process of working together and working on something like this, which was an existing enterprise but moving in a completely different direction?
I think that from a writing perspective, for me, it was so much fun to have a partner again. I don't know that that was a surprise, but it was certainly welcome, you know, to have someone who's like your intellectual equal, knows the story as well as you do, has gone through it with you. You know, I'm old enough that I don't feel I have to always shoulder that burden alone anymore. You know, like, this was just fun. It was fun to have someone else in the room. And so that to me was, you know, I don't know if it was a surprise, but it was super welcome. And then I think in the making of it, you know, there was a lot of things that were different. It's like, I'm cinematically servicing a genre that has to have like certain antecedents in it, in terms of lens choice, camera movement, cutting style, things like that, where you have to have a visual language that has tropes that are instantly recognizable or trigger a kind of familiarity so you feel like you're in that terrain. And at the same time, make it your own thing. It's in New York. It's not the same cast. Obviously, it's a different era by decades. So there are certain things that are going to be different. There are certain things that are going to be the same. So to me, that's what some of the surprises were.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I wouldn't say I was ultimately surprised by this in and of itself, but every day I was surprised by how much I learned. And getting to watch somebody like Gary work, getting to watch this incredible crew, getting to watch these women perform, you know, as a new director and coming into this world, it was like going to graduate school 100 times over. I mean, you're just soaking up so much, and you learn about craft in such a profound way. And then getting to see this sort of this end result and how wonderful it is and how delightful it is and the joy that it brings and I think will bring to audiences. That was, you know, I would sort of have to pinch myself at the end of most days that was the experience that we were getting to have and getting to sit next to Gary at the monitor and really learn. And that was a total joy.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Next up, we'll hear from Jim Dotrieve, who started his career as one of the original writers for the award-winning animated comedy King of the Hill. Dotrieve currently serves as the executive producer of the popular animated Fox television series Bob's Burgers, which he co-developed with Lauren Bouchard. I spoke with Dotrieve at Texas State University at an event put on by the Austin Film Festival and the Whitliff Collection. Clips of Bob's Burgers and King of the Hill, courtesy of 20th Century Fox Film Corporation. You were in advertising, writing advertising copy, and you just reminded me that he actually worked for a Texas TV show institution named Barney.
I worked for the company that created Barney, so it's not my fault. And I also, an affiliate of that company, I used to write the captions for animal posters. They did the Hang in There Baby cat poster. That was their famous poster. I didn't write
Hang
that one.
Hang in There Baby?
Hang in There Baby, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I came in 1995. It was the second year of the film festival. I had moved to Los Angeles from Philadelphia, where I'd been a copywriter for about 10 years. And made the big move and was going to try my hand at becoming a screenwriter. I was spending way too much time watching the OJ trial, which was going on at that time, and I needed some inspiration to get out of a rut. And I came down to Austin for the film festival, got properly inspired, and the following year I was working on King of the Hill, and I also was writing a movie script. So I came down to the film festival as a panelist in year two for me, year three for the festival. Your results may vary, I think I have to say that.
So, you know, talk to us a little bit more about how, I mean, because I don't know if this was part of your vision, but you're moving out to LA from the advertising world. Did you think animation was something that was even in the, and how did this evolution occur?
So I originally came out thinking I would to be a feature writer, but I wrote some spec TV scripts. Back at the time, everything is reversed now. Back at the time, you didn't write original material. You wrote existing shows, a sample of an existing show that someone could read and they would be familiar with the show and know whether you got it right. So I wrote a Larry Sanders spec script and a news radio spec script. But animation was not on my radar. I didn't think about it. It wasn't a goal, but I just needed, you know, I wanted a job. I wanted a writing job. And when you're starting out, you'll take anything that comes your way. I had my feature agent was a young, he was about 25, 26, 27 at the time, just starting out. And that's when you're starting out as a writer. And I was old for a writer. I was 37 at the time, so I had a crazy, you know, story and path to begin with. And I was 12 years older than my agents. And he introduced me to a TV agent there, also same age, you know, an up and comer. They've both gone on to fabulous careers. So I sort of was able to ride their success as well. And we were looking over the upcoming pilots for 1996, I guess it was, and there were shows like Cop Rock, and I think Just Shoot Me was the only other show besides this Mike Judge project. And I said, oh, I'm from Texas, and she said, oh, really? And knew a friend of a friend of Mike's, and it was just this weird set of circumstances that got me in the door. And Mike was in Austin, but Greg Daniels was his partner in LA. So I had a meeting with Greg, and we pitched him some Texas stories, and he showed me this pencil test. You know, it's very rough animation of the guys. It is available on YouTube if you hunt it down. It's pencil test that got Mike and Greg. They sold Fox on King of the Hill. He showed that to me. The thing I remember most about it was Bobby Bobby going, a bee picked my head, or a bee stung me. And that's my Bobby's rusty. So we had a good meeting, when I was talking to Greg, I wasn't looking to be in animation or anything. I was just having an interview for a job. But as I'm talking to Greg, I could tell, and he came from The Simpsons, and that's the way, you know, Fox does animation. They'll pair an outsider like Mike Judge with somebody who is in their system like Greg Daniels, and they've continued to do that. They did it with Bob's Burgers. And I said, oh, this show's going to be a good show. You know, it's not going to be a piece of crap TV show like so much was. And it made me think of everything in a whole different light. And it's an attitude and an ethic that we carried through King of the Hill, the whole time of King of the Hill, and that I've kept with me through Bob's. It's the bar was raised very high, you know, and somebody opened my eyes in the beginning of my career. And once I got in, you know, your question was about animation, but once I got into animation, I never looked back.
Talk to us a little bit about how y'all went through that development process that first year, and then as you were starting to create these characters over a time period, I guess hoping you'd be on at least a couple of seasons,
yeah.
You know, how you approach the development of, you know, Hank and Peggy and Bobby and, you know, the neighbors, all of Boomhauer, everybody. Can you kind of give us a little detail?
I never really thought too much. I never assumed that anything other than it was going to be a good show that would succeed. I had this feeling that people would embrace it, and I knew where it came from, and I knew the stories that we were telling, and because I grew up in Dallas, so I knew in a way. Some people say King of the Hill is a documentary, and I kind of support that point of view. I mean, there were two Texans on the staff. There was Johnny Hardwick, who played Dale. He was originally hired as a writer, and then when it came time to audition for Dale Gribble, he gave it a shot. He was a stand-up comedian in Austin. He would I think there was something called the Velveeta Room or something here, and he would perform there. Somehow he got out, it was in a festival or something in Colorado, and Greg saw him or found out about him, liked him, and brought him in for an interview and hired him as a writer because he knew a lot about Texas. And Johnny was the luckiest guy in Hollywood until I came around. He never had to write a spec script. It's so rare to actually get hired as a writer and not have to write unless you're a friend of a star in someone's entourage or something. It just hardly ever happens. But Johnny and I were kind of the Texas, the voices of authenticity for the show. And that's what we brought to the development process. You know, we would talk about what Texans would do in certain situations. And we introduced the writers to the Lubies and the Luann Platter and things like that. Anything in the show that is about the Cowboys pretty much came from me. But we would sit around, the writers would sit around, and we knew we had to do 13 scripts in the first season. So it's just, what story ideas do you have? And, you know, Greg would pick, and Mike would pick the most promising ones. And somehow we got 13 stories broken, and you just figure stuff out along the way. And, you know, Buck Strickland didn't have a first name, so I named him after my dad. Nancy didn't have, we didn't know what Nancy did for a living, so she became the weather girl at Channel 84. It's all that stuff. Once you get greenlit to put on a series, it's like, oh crap, we have to figure all this out, you know? So, and that's, you know, the staff started in May, I guess, and then we had our first show ran in January. And Mike and Greg had written an original pilot script, which actually had Khan in it, But Khan didn't make the pilot episode of the show. And Greg helped him flesh out the pilot episode. And, you know, and we just added things bit by bit. That's just the way the nature of a show, how it evolves, and it's in unexpected ways, and you bring in your personal experiences as I did, and everybody does. You know, you'll pitch. I know I may be stepping on some of your the topics, but writing from your personal experience. Norm Hiscock was one of our writers who worked on Saturday Night Live before he and Kids in the Hall before he came to King of the Hill. And he pitched a story about when he was young and his first broken heart when he met a girl who was younger than him who liked him but didn't like him, and he misunderstood and was crushed, and that turned into They Call It Bobby Love, which the show won an Emmy for, you know. So it's just a gradual, really fun process. The first year, you know, I said we didn't work long hours, but in the first year of a show, you have to work longer hours. You're just, because there's so much to discover. They call it expanding the world. You have to, in Bob's, for instance, we had the core characters. Lauren, you know, had already done an 11-minute presentation for the show with the characters who weren't what you all see today. There was Tina used to be a boy called Daniel. So, but what we didn't know, you know, we didn't know who their classmates were particularly, what the school was like. So you just sort of figure all that stuff. And over the course of King of the Hill, which lasted so long for a while, it was the second longest animated show. Family Guy passed it, and South Park passed it, but it had 259 episodes, which is amazing. You know, and you introduce new characters. We had Lucky. We introduced as Luann's boyfriend and husband, and we got lucky that it ended up being played by Tom Petty. In Bob's, we've added character. Oh, Chuck Mangione became a character just by a fluke. To be honest, I can't remember which episode it was, but the scene was that Hank walks in and Bobby and Peggy and Luann are doing jazzercise, and Hank is horrified that Bobby's doing jazzercise. They're jazzercise. He's dressed normally the way he always dresses, but Peggy and Luann are in leotards.
My Game Boy's out of batteries. I need to get on the Nintendo. Quick!
Just a minute, Bobby. Get ready to turn and turn. Way to go, Bobby. Hi, Uncle Hank.
Shut that off. Bobby, stop dancing now.
He is not just dancing. He's firming his thighs and tightening his buttocks.
Watch your mouth.
So we were just bouncing around the music they're listening to is the lamest music imaginable. So I started humming Feel So Good, and one of the other writers identified it. And he said, oh, Feels So Good, Chuck Mangione. And one thing leads to another. This is how in bad circumstances people die. But then in good circumstances, somebody called Chuck Mangione or his agent and said, do you want to be on the show? And he said yes, so he ended up being on the show for years, and we would write these cameos where whenever there was any kind of ceremonial thing which called for the national anthem or something, he would start playing whatever it was and then break in to Feel So Good. So I believe me, nobody anticipated anything like that when King of the Hill began, but that's what happens with shows.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about animation, and probably quite a bit different than when you started writing and were writing spec scripts, is that in that world, your characters really don't grow older, and they visually don't grow older like an actor would. And current events are tough because it takes a while to animate. And so by the time it's animated, it's gone, except for maybe the OJ trial. That might have worked in there. But how do you address that when you're developing the show? And also, how do you make your characters, instead of necessarily growing up, fill out?
So I remember Greg Daniels in the beginning had an idea that maybe the characters would age 1 year for every 2 years in actual reality. So you have to be incremental. It's like every once in a while someone can have a birthday, because the voices stay the same, your actors stay the same, you know, and you have, you know, Pam Adlon was playing Bobby, and she did, you know, you didn't want to mess with that, you know, and I don't know, Bobby might have had one birthday. Joseph went through puberty. We did that consciously, you know, but he went away for the summer and came back and it had gone through puberty, and we had changed act. He was done by Brittany Murphy originally, and then after he went through puberty, he was played by Brecken Meyer, who did a wonderful job with him, and it opened up different kinds of jokes and different kind of relationship between him and Bobby. But you have to be careful about it, and you also have to suspend your disbelief, because King of the Hill started in 1997. We always said Hank was about 40, so that means he would have been born in 1957, give or take. So his references and his reality was that. Well, then the show's still on the air, you know, 13 years later. He's still 40. The references are completely different than they were when the show started. So that's one reason to avoid topical humor, or to not pay much attention to it if you're a viewer and go, that's still funny, I don't really care. But we never made many changes. We went down some dead ends where we had a few episodes where Hank and Peggy were trying to have a baby, and we found it too hard to write and not all that fun and funny. So we just changed it, and we had Luann move away, and we did a couple of seasons of that, and then we decided, let's have her move back. It's easier to have her in the show if she's around. So you don't change too much, and you give character attributes. You discover things, and the actors discover things that, like Peggy being a Boggle champion, that wasn't initially. I think it might have ended that we did the episode maybe in the first season, but it wasn't the initial conception of her. And on Bob's, we do, you know, we don't have big changes, and we sort of reset at the end of an episode. There was an episode, it was one of our craziest episodes with the mechanical shark. Do you remember that one? And it somehow goes from Wonder Wharf all the way through the town and digs its way underneath the street and into Bob's restaurant. And Bob and Teddy are saved by the yogurt machine. A soft serve yogurt machine that got stuck in the shark's mouth.
I'm torn. Dad raised me, but the shark gets me.
If the shark eats our restaurant, is he our new boss?
Shark boss!
I'm blacking out, Bobby!
I don't know how to stop it. We've tried everything.
It's too bad we can't make it die from cancer like in the movie.
It didn't die from cancer, Teddy.
Oh, no, you're right. They shot the cancer ending, but it tested really bad. It didn't have the pow.
Really? Cancer? No pow?
Yeah, they shot a whole new ending, remember? They went and poured wet cement down his throat.
Yeah, and that would be really helpful if we had a cement mixer.
Maybe we do. The ice cream machine.
She's right! We could fill up the shark with ice cream. That might mess it up, right?
I chose you, Dad.
Thanks, Tina.
Over the shark.
Thanks.
Because I thought...
Yes.
Originally, it looked like maybe I would...
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, Dad. Who was Tina really gonna choose? A broken down wreck with the dead eyes or a fake shark?
Aww.
You like that, Mom?
Yeah.
Okay, let's give it a try. All I have to do is plug it in.
But the yogurt machine was dented, and it wasn't dented before, but if you look at any show done since then, it's still dented. So we enjoy those kinds of little continuity bits.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Bob's Burgers showrunner, Jim Dotrieve. Dotrieve started his career as one of the original writers for King of the Hill, which ran for 13 seasons on the Fox network. The series won 2 Emmy Awards and was named one of the 100 greatest television shows of all time in 2007.
One of my favorite episodes is A Beer Can Named Desire. Does anybody remember that? Super Bowl? Yeah. So that was Jim's episode. And still, even on paper, one of the funniest things I'd ever read. And of course, seeing it created after I'd read it was really an amazing experience. The way you all would do it on King of the Hill was you would come up for it being your episode, right?
Yeah.
And then you'd have to go off for a couple of weeks by yourself after you pitch some ideas and go write that episode, right? Can you talk about that?
That skips a couple of steps. So yeah, I would pitch the idea and have it worked out enough where it goes to sell it to Greg and Mike. And that one was just they take a road trip to New Orleans, ostensibly plot-wise, because Hank has won an opportunity. You see this sometimes where at halftime somebody will throw a football at a target. And I remember Dr. Pepper used to sponsor that at the Sugar Bowl, where you'd try to throw it through a Dr. Pepper can, and you'd win, you know, a whole lot of money if you got it through. Again, you have to suspend disbelief a little bit that they would actually get the can that enables them to go down to New Orleans to do this. But and of course the guys wanted to go on the trip with Hank and Peggy, and Luann had to go because it was her beer can, but she was underage, so Hank wouldn't let her do it because she would be arrested. And they had to stop along the way in the bayou to visit Bill's relatives, and this is all drawing from, you know, my Cajun relatives in the bayou in Louisiana. So and then I went off and wrote the script, and it was just kind of a perfect storm of living my dream, because I got to tell this funny story about Bill meeting his Cajun relatives, and they lived on a sort of faded plantation, and he had 3 cousins that 2 of them he knew he was related to by blood, and one who he was related to by marriage. They were all widows, because they had a line that I wrote for the script was that one of his cousins says, "The Louisiana diet will kill a man as surely as a sword." And
this is my husband, Jirac. The Louisiana diet will kill a man as surely as a sword.
So, Ro, you're not married?
I'm all alone in this world, William.
And they were all coming on to him, so he desperately wanted to get on the make with one of his cousins, but he had to find the one that he wasn't actually a blood relative to. So that was sort of the B story for this. And then they go on to New Orleans for the last act and leave Bill behind to do whatever's going to happen to him. And Hank meets one of his childhood heroes, who was one of mine, who was Dandy Don Meredith, who was my first quarterback. You never forget your first quarterback. So Hank decides that he's going to take the sure thing. He makes less money if Dandy throws the ball than if he took the throw himself, but he decides he'll let Dandy Don make the throw. And Dandy Don misses it, and then he loses his head and tackles him in the middle of the field because he's so angry that he cost him Bobby's college education, as he sees it. And the matriarch of Bill's family, who was named Esme after my grandmother, was played by Meryl Streep. And the Dixie Chicks played the cousins, his cousins. So it doesn't get better than that. It just doesn't.
Well, so let's talk a bit about how you then make this transition to Bob's Burgers and how that happened, and the role you play now is really more of a showrunner producer. You wrote some episodes in the beginning, but really now you're facilitating the show and Lauren's vision. Can you talk
exactly
about that?
Yeah, the Fox model, which I alluded to earlier, is they take someone from inside and someone from outside. So we met, we were in sync on our sensibility and where we saw things, and we just started doing those things, you know, of turning this 11-minute thing into a show. They made us do some animation, some sample animation. We got greenlit in like Thanksgiving week of 2009. I think they had maybe made us ordered scripts before they picked us up. So collaborated on 4 stories and scripts, along with Nora Smith, who was She started as a staff writer, but she was somebody who was working with Lauren in San Francisco. She had worked on his prior show, Lucy, Daughter of the Devil, on cable. Lauren came from cable world. He had done home movies. So he had a very good relationship with her, and she's brilliant. And so the three of us worked on these four stories. Fox liked them. They picked up the show. And then we were able to hire a staff. So it takes a good 2 years to get a cartoon on the air. And chances are you're not going to, but if you do, that's how long it's going to take at a minimum. And one of the key things that happened in the development process was Kevin Riley, who was the head of Fox Television at the time. Originally, the kids were Gene and Louise and Daniel. And Daniel was played by Dan Mintz, and he had this sort of Asperger-y affect. And Kevin said, we try to differentiate between the characters a little more. So Lauren had the genius idea, which is just make Daniel a girl named Tina, and still have Dan Mintz play Tina. So we didn't change the voice, nothing. It's exact. If you ever see the demo that Lauren did originally, Daniel and Tina talk exactly the same. That was one, in my opinion, that was one of the two key decisions that made the show successful, was Daniel becoming Tina, because even though Tina is played by a grown man, teenage girls in particular just embraced Tina as a character. And you know, and I can't tell you how many times I've seen online Tina as my spirit animal, and you know, and someone asked me my favorite character on the show, and I love them all, but I think if I had to pick one, I'd pick Tina. It was scripted in one of the early episodes where Tina makes a uncomfortable noise, and we didn't know exactly what that was going to be, and that's when Dan said,
"Wow. Look how big and empty the parking lot is, huh? What do you say you get behind the wheel?"
What would I do behind the wheel?
Drive.
Is that legal?
Well, no, but my father let me drive when I was about your age. Call it a perk for running errands with your dad.
Let's make this kitty purr.
Well, go ahead, try a turn. Tina, why are you groaning? You're doing fine. Tina, relax. Easy. Okay. Tina, you're kind of headed toward the only other car in the lot. You have plenty of time to turn, Tina, so just go ahead. Turn one way or the other. You're just swerving back and forth. Turn one way and stick with it, Tina. Tina, for the love of God, turn away or stop! The brakes, Tina, on the left! You're about to hit that car! The brakes! Hit the brakes!
And that is Tina's catchphrase, basically, you know, and she says it a lot.
I'm going to move to one of my other really favorite episodes, which you did co-write, which is Crawl Space. So can you talk about how you mentioned Human Flesh became the pilot?
It was basically the story of Human Flesh was the first half of what became the pilot. It's the same premise where there's a rumor going around that Bob's serving human flesh. And that had its roots in Lauren's original conception of the show, which he pitched, which is that they were cannibals, that they killed bad people and then ground them up and served them as burgers. And Fox said, "We like everything except the cannibal part." So Lauren, you know, he was like, "Fine, but it doesn't, you know, they don't have to be cannibals." But it led to a rumor of cannibalism became the inspiration behind his demo. But he only had half of the story, and you know, it was like 11 minutes, so it had to become 22. And he was getting some people from the network at the time saying, "Oh, you don't want this to be your pilot. You want this to be like your sixth episode or something." There's this idea that you don't tell origin stories as your pilot. I don't subscribe to that myself. I think it can work either way. You can start midstream and then back flashback and tell people how things began. Or you can just spoon feed them and say, "This is the beginning. This is how these people meet," you know, and just go from there. So Human Flesh, originally we were trying to work Burger War, the one where he's having the war with Jimmy Pesto, We tried to make that the first episode in the pilot, but it wasn't coming together as easily as a story, and the animation wasn't coming together, so it took longer. So we just went back to, let's keep it simple, let's turn human flesh into the pilot. And then we had to have the, more story ideas, and we had a handful of them. One of them was Crawl Space. Lauren had worked as a cable computer cable guy, and he'd worked in running cable in crawl spaces in office buildings. And I guess that was sort of the inspiration for what if Bob, is stuck in the crawl space of the apartment. And so that led to, what would get him there? And it's the combination of a leaky roof because it's raining, and his in-laws are coming to town and he wants to get away from them. And I personally, at the time, I was like, I love this story. I think it's too soon to do it. I think it's like should be like the fifth or sixth episode, because we need to give the audience time to understand who these people are and what the, what the formula is of the show, if you will. I was wrong. The network said, no, we like the story. We're not afraid of it being the second episode. And that was an instance where I was following a rule that didn't need to be followed. So we slotted it as the second episode, and it's a tremendous one. It starts with it raining, and Lauren was afraid himself. He was like, worried about how much rain to have, how loud to hear it, because rain is just sleepy. It makes you want to go to sleep. And it's like, that's the worst thing you want when you're watching a TV program, is a comedy cartoon, is to be sleepy. And he has the same feeling about music, which is the second great ingredient of our show as it developed, I think, is that the music shouldn't be too low energy, low tempo, or too good. It should have high energy, a certain amount of silliness and fun, and kind of, he always had the Bollywood musical numbers as sort of his model or inspiration. So if you'll notice, since season two, every episode ends with a musical credit sequence, and it's one of the things, along with Burgers of the Day and the on the storefronts in Rat Fans, those things that that people look forward to because they're different in every episode.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about the show, a couple of things in particular, that there's a lot of film reference, yeah. In a lot of the episodes. Yeah, but it's funny, it's always done in a really, kind of tongue-in-cheek way. Yeah. And is that something that the writer's room is particularly, was it a plan or was it something that evolved?
Well, Crawl Space, we have the second episode, we have The Shining in it when Kuchi Kopi is first introduced. So that's been part of our thing forever.
Wow, there's a speakeasy in the crawl space. What a great idea.
Nice to see you, Mr. Bob.
Nice to see you, Kuchi Kopi.
What'll it be, Mr. Bob?
Give me some hooch. Your best bootleg hooch.
How are things going, Mr. Bob?
Things could be better, Coochie. Things could be a whole lot better.
Do you need to use the facilities, Mr. Bob? Go number two?
I'm glad you asked, Coochie. Yes, I do need to go number two. Yes, I do. A lot.
Yeah, we do homages all the time. It's fun, and people like them, but we do try to put a spin on them that it's not just something that you would see everywhere. I have to say, this to me is one of the keys to Bob's success, is how, and it shares it a little bit with King of the Hill in that they're both warm, good-hearted shows, but Bob's, is so kind to everyone, and so non-judgmental, and people recognize that and appreciate it for that.
Well, there's also really, and I'm wondering how the writer's room got chosen, especially coming from somebody who spent so long in a writer's room. I mean, you really only had two shows in three per IMDb, but two really, and two shows in 22 years, which is an incredibly unique.
I'm really very inexperienced. I've only had two jobs. Well, I knew what to do right, and that was one of my the roles and contributions to Bob's, even though I don't write, was I knew from King of the Hill that shows I knew you don't have to work with a-holes, pardon my initials. Life's too short, and you don't have to work long and terrible hours, and you can enjoy your job and your family and surround yourself with good, talented people. There's plenty of them out there. So when we started staffing King of the Hill in that, that was sort of the essence of it and of my job to facilitate and make help Lauren realize his vision.
For more On Story, check your local PBS station for our television show of the same name. Every episode is a surprising and intimate look at filmmaking. Check your local listings, stream from PBS, or go to onstory.tv.
Let's talk about you and Bill Dotrieve and what you have in common.
We're both bald. We're both overweight. I actually tried. I think I was out of the room when they came up with the idea of. It was in season one, early on, when we were breaking stories, and I had gone out to get something to eat or something. And I came back in, and they said, "Hey Jim, how would you feel if we named Bill Dotrieve?" And I was like, I didn't really hesitate because I knew it was done in love, and I also knew this will live almost forever. So it's my little shot at semi-immortality or whatever. And so I was like, okay, all right. But I think they did that because besides those physical things, similarities, I had actually, because Johnny had gotten the part of Dale, I conned myself into thinking, deluded myself into thinking, oh, maybe I could be Bill. You know, I'm from Texas, I'm a writer, why can't I be Bill? So I got a cassette recording and recorded the lines from the original pilot script and Bill's lines. And his character in the beginning was different, actually. He was a much more aggressive drill sergeant. We changed that because it's that meld between the writer and the actor. Stephen Root played him brilliantly and he played him dumb but good-hearted, and the dumber Bill got, the funnier he got, and the more pathetic he got, the funnier he got, so that's how he sort of evolved. But I had done my little horrible audition tape of Bill, and they felt sorry for me, so I think that was their payback. Greg Daniels said the only thing standing between you and the role of Bill Dotrieve is Stephen Root's beating heart. So.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.